So, hey, Wish, what'd you have for lunch today?
I can't tell you that.
Okay, what did you have for breakfast?
I'm gonna keep that in the kitchen there, Merrick.
Did you get to sleep late last night?
No.
Hey, where'd you grow up, by the way? I never asked you that.
I'm gonna keep that in the family album.
You got brothers and sisters, right?
No.
Sorry, what was that? Was that a yes or no?
I'm not gonna tell you.
How do you tie your shoes? Do you, laces? You a Velcro guy? You slip-ons? What kind of footwear do you like?
I'm gonna keep that in the closet. By the way, that didn't sound right. No. Ladies and gentlemen, that's if every radio show was done by John Tortorella press conferences. Before we talk about torts, by the way, I just want to state something at the top of the show. Losing to Finland in the final seconds is valorous. It shows that you've competed against the best in the world. Taking a kneeing penalty and losing to Slovakia is embarrassing. And Canada should feel shame.
The role of Greg Wyshynski on today's podcast, played by Ryan Lambert, ladies and gentlemen, played by Ryan Lambert. Oh, by the way, the Canada ousting does have an NHL trickle-down effect to it. You know what that is?
What's that?
Does Edmonton now make up their minds about Tom Rennie, considering how much Tambellini and Lowe were involved in the World Hockey Championships with Team Canada? Now do they finally get around to not letting Tom Rennie twist in the wind anymore?
Are you saying that, because the common perception is that Brent Sutter might take over for Rennie, right?
The big rumor.
So you think that not only do they get done with this tournament, they can focus their attention on their own team, but now maybe they have a better understanding of the ins and outs of Brent Sutter world and can make a decision on him too.
And more so, and this is where if you want to get really tinfoil about this and you say, well, hang on a second, are they treating Team Canada this year like a little audition for Brent Sutter, and are they treating this as an audition for maybe the first overall draft pick? There were a lot of eyebrows raised when they took Ryan Murray from the Everett Silvertips, an 18-year-old defenseman, to go and play in this tournament. Because, you know, the Edmonton Oilers brass pretty much, you know, ran Team Canada this year. There was a lot of eyebrows raised. Are they auditioning, or are they using this as a little litmus test for how Ryan Murray does when he mixes with pros?
Where do you stand on Rennie, by the way?
I think Rennie deserves at least another year.
Yeah?
Well, I mean, we keep hearing, you know, things like five-year plan, and this is it's still a team that's on the grow, and, you know, they're not ready to actualize yet. And if that's true, don't you think you at least need to give them one more season?
Here's what I think.
Maybe two?
I think that sometimes you have to make decisions based on the quality of the candidate available. Like, for example, I think Davis Payne is a pretty good coach, but he ain't Ken mm-hmm. Hitchcock. Mm-hmm. I think Tom Rennie is a pretty good coach. I think Brent Sutter is a better coach, to be quite honest.
Based on
everything I've seen, based on his time in New Jersey, based on the style of hockey that he coaches.
I'll tell you why.
I think he's a better fit for Edmonton than Rennie is.
I think he is as well, although I do like Tom Rennie, and I think Rennie deserves another chance. And if you're going to go by the best candidate available, then I think you do go with Brent Sutter for one very specific reason. He works really well with kids, whether it's the World Juniors, where I don't think he's lost on the international stage, whether it's running the Red Deer Rebels, and even though he wasn't there, he was already coaching in New Jersey. Let's not forget that Ryan Nugent-Hopkins went through that program in Red Deer. So if the premium is on youth in Edmonton as it is, as far as a top-notch candidate goes, I think Brent Sutter is the right mix. But Tom was your guy, and you were going to stick with your guy, and I guess another candidate appears who looks a little prettier, so maybe you invite that candidate to the dance eventually.
I wouldn't go that far.
What?
A little prettier?
What?
Listen,
what?
I'm waiting for Brent Sutter to defeat Frodo and take the ring.
Just don't expect any smiles in Edmonton when one of the Sutters shows up.
All right, so Tom Rennie, of course.
Was it that Chris Chelio said about the Sutters? Of course it looks like they're working hard. They can't skate.
So Tom Rennie used to coach the Rangers. Brent Sutter used to coach the Devils, which brings us to the joyous news that we bring you on this Thursday, which is, of course, not only did the New Jersey Devils hang on to defeat the Rangers 3-2 in Game 2 of the Eastern Conference Final, but they did so based on a goal by
Who? Greg Wyshynski, the guy that scored 3 goals this year, all them game winners, who? Or the guy that scored 5 playoff goals in his career, all 4 of the 5 have been GWGs. What does that stand for again? I'm a little new to the game here, you understand. That's right, when you want a clutch goal, you go to number 23, David Clarkson. I don't cheer for teams, I cheer for players. It's a happy moment for me because one of my favorite hockey players scored that. And you know what, when you look at that tip, did that tip to you look like a third line tip or a first line tip?
That was a first line tip, sir.
Thank you. That wasn't stick on the ice and hope the defenseman shoots at it. That was batting it out of the air and around Henrik Lundqvist.
Yeah,
that's
it was
a first-line skill tip right there.
It was the difference between the tip that Ryan Carter had and the tip that Clarkson had. And again, it was a crazy little moment where it looked like that might be a high stick, but he bought it down. It was a really nice deflection. So what you get out of the Devils in Game 2 is this. You get a nasty snipe from Kovalchuk on the power play. You get deflection from Carter, deflection from Clarkson, and you get that on a night in which the Devils had 10 fewer shots blocked than they had in Game 1. So, again, listen, I don't know if Pete DeBoer is going to wind up getting this team to the promised land, but say this about the guy. Game 1 to Game 2, full marks to him for A, scrambling the lines, and they got a great offensive push from the new combinations, and B, in the first period, the Devils completely abandoned what they were trying to do offensively in Game 1. You saw almost nothing from the points. You saw a bunch of work in the corners, down low, trying to get as few point shots as possible. Yep. And then when they did shoot from the point, it was quick. It was fast. It wasn't overthinking it. So when DeBoer comes out and says, look, their shot blocking ain't the thing, man. We've got a plan. We got an idea on how to get through this. I was like, bullshit. But you watch what they did in Game 2, and it wasn't. They got through
it. You know what I thought of last night? Hang on, let me grab this. I got this on my shelf here right now. I got this 2 weeks ago. I went to the Sport Card Memorabilia Show.
It's a fleshlight.
Oh. No, it is not a fleshlight.
Oh, okay. What's my second guess?
I already have a couple of those in the back. Nights, you understand, you know.
Jeez, cold, bitter nights in the Canadian Arctic. The only one that can give you all the loving you need is a plastic doohickey.
Could have used one last night when Clarkson put that goal in, but that's another story. Okay, you know what I picked up? I picked up a book called Russian Hockey Coach Tarasov Tells How to Win the Olympics.
This sounds translated.
It is, by Anatoly Tarasov. So it's a book in the old Russian coach, Anatoly Tarasov. And he heralded in probably, you know, the golden era, internationally anyhow, of Russian hockey. And I thought of the New Jersey Devils last night because I saw him playing what Tarasov would have described as a Russian style. When Tarasov was putting together teams in the late 60s and into the 70s, and we all think of 1972, he looked back at the 1963 World Championships. And by the way, Canada's out the World Championships this year. The USA is out the World Championships this year. Alas. So he looked at the 1963 team, which was the most successful Soviet hockey team up until that point. And what he noticed was that the Soviet squad won because, and it seems so simple, but he said, what I did was I looked at those games and I counted the passes. And I noticed that the top teams, like the first gold medal teams, had passed more than the silver medal team. The silver medal team passed more than the bronze medal team and all the way down the line. So the key was a lot of passes will confuse players and get them out of position. And I thought of that when I looked at the New Jersey Devils yesterday. Dots down is where the game was won for New Jersey. And what did the Devils do better than we've seen probably all playoff long? They moved the puck. And they had Rangers moving back and forth. Specifically, they had Lundqvist going back and forth. It's hard to get down for a shot. And shot blocking, which, as you know, it's just a matter of timing. And it's hard to time when the puck keeps moving east-west and you don't know when they're going to shoot. So it seemed as if the strategy was just keep moving it back and forth until you get someone out of position. And at that point, take the shot. It seemed like that old Tarasov style, move the puck, get him out of position hockey.
It also helps when you've got a step on your opponents. And I thought the Devils had a bit
That's
more
true.
Of a spark in Game 2. The Rangers sort of regressed a little bit. You know, the shot blocking thing is so funny to watch in these playoffs because it really has become the new neutral zone trap debate for the hockey media. Because what's happened now is we had shot blocking hysteria last round with the Caps and Rangers. And now what you have is the backlash against the shot blocking hysteria, where you had people tweeting, well, actually, shot blocks are down from the previous postseason. You got people, no, it's not the scourge of the NHL. It's not the new paradigm. You know, of the top shot blocking teams, this percentage of them missed the playoffs. It's been a really amazing thing to watch to see how many people are you know, wearing sandwich boards saying the end is nigh about shot blocking in the playoffs. And now how many people are like, no, 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 you silly heretics. This shot blocking has always been there. It's not a big deal.
Is that just because, and it seems as if, you know, the news cycle now being, you know, once upon a time it was 24 hours. Now the churn is, what, 3 hours? You just need to continually create new narratives to explain the game. And like we were talking about on the podcast yesterday, I just see this as one continual game. Like going back to when I first started watching hockey in 75, I just see one continual game. That's why I don't get too frantic about things. Because I just see this as one sort of game that just that began in 1975 when I first started watching and will just continue until I, you know, cease to share oxygen with everybody. But it has been part of the game at all times. And it's always interesting and always it's always interesting to watch someone break someone else's strategy. And there will be, listen, there will be a new clutching and grabbing. It was shot blocking. There'll be another shot blocking, and that's who knows what. But guaranteed, there will be another scourge in the NHL once this shot block. I'll tell you what, the one thing about shot blocking, and I was thinking about this with the Marian Gaborik suspension, benching last night. He was sat down essentially for what? Not getting the puck out of the zone, led to the goal, and kind of, you know, doing the, well, I guess it's not doing the shot block that most Rangers do, which is really dangerous but really successful, where you go down on one knee and bring your hands to your side so you're really covering a lot of area. Well, man, that's going to hurt.
It's especially dangerous when you know the Devils are aiming for their faces, as we learned from the New York Post yesterday.
Thank you, Marty. But did you see how Gabrick went out to the point to block that shot? Could his knees have been tighter together? Could his legs have been tighter together? And could his body have scrunched up even more when he went out to block that shot yesterday? Hey, listen, I understand that. I don't want to block shots. No one wants to block shots. Ask Ryan McDonagh how much he loved blocking shots last night. But I couldn't help but thinking about one thing, and this really speaks to the generational shift in the NHL. And I don't know whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. I suspect it's a bad thing because no one wants to see star players get hurt or, in Gabrick's case last night, embarrassed and then benched. You know the guy sitting above John Tortorella? The guy with the gray hair that has the unlit cigar in his mouth all the time? What's that guy's name again, Wish?
Glenn Sather?
Yeah, he used to coach a team by the name of the Edmonton Oilers. They had a guy on the team, number 99, who was a pretty good hockey player. Set a lot of records that'll probably never be even approached, let alone broken. Do you think for one second that Glenn Sather, if he had Wayne Gretzky on his team right now, and Gretzky sheepishly went to the point, didn't block a shot, that he would be sat down? No, I'm not comparing Gabrick to Gretzky, but I'm saying I like shot blocking. I understand why it's valuable. I just don't want to see everybody do it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't like it when I see stars blocking a lot of shots. It's kind of cool every now and then when you see someone like, hey, Brad Richards got in front of a shot. I want to see it once. I don't want to see guys like Brad Richards or Sidney Crosby or Claude Giroux. I don't want to see these Steven Stamkos going down and blocking a lot of shots. I just don't. I don't want to see them turn themselves into Jay McKees. That's what I don't like about shot. The only thing I don't like about shot blocking right now is that everybody does it.
In which Jeff Merrick compares Marian Gaborik to Wayne Gretzky. All of Slovakia thanks you, sir, but honestly...
Well, listen, the Slovaks did fell Canada today, so I guess there's something there.
I did not have a problem with the benching, to be honest with you, because I think Gaborik is the kind of player that, A, can use the motivation, and B, when your team is not skating the way you think it should, you can use him as an example and then bring him back, and then hopefully not only do you get a spark out of him, but you get everybody else saying, well, if that guy had to pay the price, I better get my ass in gear. I didn't have a problem with benching at all.
But, man, it's dangerous when you do it in a tight game in the playoffs where you could be up 2-0 heading into New Jersey with almost a stranglehold. Do you think he should have been out there in that final minute? You know, the draw in the New Jersey Devils zone. There's Brad Richards. There's Chris Kreider. There's Ryan Callahan. Looking around for Gaborik. Is he over there? Is he by the boards? Is he in the hash marks? No Marian Gaborik in that final faceoff. Should he have been out there?
Probably.
It's a lot of skill to leave on the bench, man. I understand sitting him down for most of the period. I get that. To your point, Wish, I totally understand that. But
it wasn't a Marian Gaborik kind of game, though, was it?
I don't know.
A lot of Devils forecheck, a lot of Devils pressure inside the Rangers D zone. You know, it wasn't a whole lot of counterpunching from the Rangers.
It's an offensive zone faceoff, don't you? I can understand if it's in the Ranger zone. Okay, do we want Gabrick there? No, probably not.
For that faceoff, he's got a wicked shot. But for the rest of the game though, it wasn't really his kind of game. So Tortorella basically gave him the Alex Semin treatment. You know what I mean? Not your time. You sit down. I thought that what the Devils did in Game 2 was impressive. It reminded me of Game 2 against the Flyers, in which they kind of took over and played their style, dictated terms to the opponent. That said, it was a game in which you felt that if the Rangers could tie it, then we might be going back to the Jersey 2-0. But instead, it's 1-1, and you know, now it's the Rangers' turn. Now the puck's in their end. And I wish, I'm sure John Tortorella on his conference call today was a lot more candid and open about the Rangers' plans. You just can't expect to get it out of him during a press conference. We're going to talk to Kevin Allen about that later on. He's from USA Today. He's also the big wig at the Professional Hockey Writers Association. And a lot of those guys are carping right now about the way Tortorella is working these press conferences and whether or not it's fair to the writers. And then we're also going to have an actual celebrity on the show today, Merrick.
We are. Dean McDermott, my former defense partner from Men's League Hockey, will be joining us to talk about the hockey scene in Los Angeles. Now, he's an expat living in L.A., so I know him. I talked to him last night. Him and Torrey have been to one L.A. Kings playoff game so far.
That'd be Torrey Spelling for those of you.
T-Spelling. Yes, T-Spelling, ladies. Who's, you know what? She's like an insanely cool, like down to earth chick. I went to Dean was in town a couple of years ago. We went to a Washington Capitals game, and I swear Torrey Spelling was, out of anyone at the Air Canada Center, probably more into it than anybody else at the ACC. She's just like, because I had when Dean first told me that they were getting together and all that, I was like, what? She's like, you have all the Hollywood stereotypes, right? I just know her from Beverly Hills 90210. And then the first time I met her.
Straighten your tie, you're like, can you introduce me to Shannon Doherty?
I was like, Dino, what are you doing? And she's like, honestly, she's like the most incredibly down-to-earth chick you'll ever meet. She's like, and she's so perfect for Dean, too. She's just like, I mean this as a compliment. She's like a Canadian chick, right? She's just like laid back, totally chill, want to watch the hockey game. So we'll talk to Dino about the Kings scene in LA right now.
You just paid the ultimate compliment to half our audience and the other half of the audience sharpening their claws for you.
Sorry,
sir.
Ladies of the United States. I apologize. I love you too.
All right, with that, let's start the show proper, shall we?
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
That's a hockey, you know. It's only a game. Why do you have to be mad?
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
Sabine is not English for punch me or headlock me in a scrum.
Debate hockey, pop culture, and more hockey. Merrick versus Wyshynski.
All right, before we rock and roll with hockey stuff, I wanted to talk about this Colin Cowherd thing.
What?
Okay, here's the thing. So a couple people have been asking me about it. Colin Cowherd is a hacky ESPN radio host who's very, very good at getting people to talk about him. And what he said today, he talked about hockey media today on his show. And what Colin said was about the like Tortorella press conferences. He basically called the hockey media amateurish. You're getting a lot of young, cheap people covering hockey, and it's not like newspapers send their best people to hockey. Fox News doesn't send Bill O'Reilly to a speed bump proposal in his hometown. Hockey doesn't get the cream of the crop in our business. The guy covering the Florida Panthers, he was at a floral show earlier in the week. Well, the Florida Panthers are out of the playoffs, and sometimes reporters have to take other gigs, depending on what their editors tell them to do. That stuff, you can listen to the audio clip on awfulannouncing.com, but that's what Cowherd had to say. I'm insulted by it, obviously, because I think he's more talking about the quality of the work than the people actually in the hockey media. I mean, he's obviously wrong, first of all, about like the young aspect of it. You go to any press box in the NHL, it is not the CW. It is not Romper Room. It is a bunch of crusty old people that hate hockey now because they've been on the beat for the last 20 years.
Can I ask you one question?
Sure, please, yeah.
Because in Canada, that's what, you know, the majority of writers aspire to. You want to be on the NHL beat. That's what everybody aspires to. In the United States, is it true or not that the entry-level position or the entry-level gig for most newspapers in the sports department is hockey? Like, you don't walk right in and start, okay, you're on the NFL beat. Okay, you're on the Major League Baseball beat. You're on the NBA beat. Is that not true?
You are absolutely right. You're right, and that's what I was going to say. That what he said was not completely inaccurate.
Okay.
Usually, because the hierarchy of sports for a U.S. newspaper, hockey is considered to be in some places, not everyone. I mean, it's a coveted position in Pittsburgh. It's a coveted position in Detroit, Boston, obviously. In some cases, and I'm specifically thinking about Nashville and Washington D.C. It's been an entry level spot for writers that then ascended to cover like the NFL. In D.C., a guy named Jason Lockenfora wrote hockey. He moved to the Redskins. He moved to NFL Network. Mm-hmm. Rachel Alexander at the time covered hockey, moved up to other stuff, and is now Rachel Nichols of ESPN. So. In Nashville, our good buddy Josh Cooper got the gig because John Glennon was the beat writer, and then I think he moved on to cover the Tennessee Titans. So,
yeah, so at the Tennessean.
It's a breeding ground for talent. So from that aspect, it's true. The young and cheap thing, not necessarily so. And it's not true for every city. The misnomer, though, and this is what he's trying to do, is that there's anything amateurish about the writers covering hockey. Because that's not the case. The simple fact of the matter is that just like in any media situation, you got to wait your turn. And in the U.S., the guys covering baseball and football and whatever are entrenched. The bright, young, next wave of writers sometimes has to go cover hockey instead. It's just the way it is. But he's being an ass. I mean, listen, I know a lot of people in hockey media. I know a lot of people in other media. Some of the best and brightest are writing hockey. I mean, without question. I mean, people that can put it together. Like Nick Costaneka, for example, from Yahoo, I would put up against any of the other Yahoo columnists covering any sport. The guy paints a picture. The guy knows where to find a story and knows how to present a story. And just because he's covering hockey doesn't mean he should be ghettoized by someone like Colin Cowherd.
See, I don't care about the age, whether they're entry level. Oh, is this your first job? I won't take you seriously. All I care about, like, I don't care what's on the birth certificate. All I care about is if it's good or not, right? And I think in a lot of ways too. And I know that I noticed this most specifically when I read the Theory of Ice blog, Ellen's blog. That because even by her own admission, she's relatively new to coming at the game. We talked about this when we had her on too, and that's a really fresh perspective. Like a lot of writers for and broadcasters for that matter, and wish you kind of hinted at it, start to hate the game after a while. And you bring that, 20 years of baggage along with you and 20 years of assumption that you can't break. And that's how you approach your work. And that's why a lot of it seems, predictable. And when you shoot for controversy, it seems really forced because you get the feeling that that's not you. So to be honest with you, I kind of like working in an environment where there's a lot of the grizzled vets, a lot of the guys, and there's a whole generation, the Dick Beddoes of the world, the Jack Fallas of the world that have, that are no longer with us. Jim Coleman was another great one, that are no longer with us. But we still have a generation of older writers and older broadcasters, but we also have a healthy mix of fresh ideas and people that are new to the sport. And when you're new to the sport, you don't come along with a lot of assumptions. Like, I'm the first to call BS on myself all the time because, I've watched this game for too damn long. Right, I've watched this for too long, and it takes me. It's even though I try to be as open-minded about this game as possible, and try to look for reasons for change and massaging of it. I bring a lot of assumptions to the game, and I'll be honest about that. And when I read Ellen's Theory of Ice blog, or when I read like a lot of quote unquote younger writers, it's interesting to me. As long as you approach it with an open mind, and you don't just dismiss it by saying, "Oh, entry level, what can you possibly tell me? I've been watching the game for 35 years. What can I possibly learn from you?" You can learn a lot as long as your mind is open to it. So I don't really care about whether, it's a junior writers and, not the creme de la creme. As long as you have something compelling to say, I don't care how old you are or how long you've worked in the industry. I don't.
And your point is extraordinarily true because it's because of that complacency in some cases and a lack of of curiosity anymore after doing the gig for so long, that spawned the blogosphere. That was the blogosphere grew because it was a reaction to the mainstream media and its lack of creativity in covering the game. And so we up their game and they up our game. And it's a symbiotic thing, and now we are where we are.
You know, and you know what actually helped the blogosphere, I think, more than anything else, was the last lockout. And that was the really – that was the big eruption of the hockey blogosphere, because a lot of mainstream writers, a lot of mainstream broadcasters as well, got reassigned to do something else. And where was hockey kept alive? On the internet. Right? Like all throughout – there's a couple of sports. These the two sports that I mainly gravitate towards. One is UFC, which was kept alive, you know, when it was off pay-per-view in the United States for however many years. It was kept alive on the internet. In Canada, we always had it on Viewer's Choice, but still very much kept alive on the internet. So that sport specifically always has a lot to thank when it comes to the blogosphere of the internet. And I think hockey was as well, back in 2004, 2005, when a lot of those writers got, okay, we got one guy covering the CBA negotiations, and you other guys who were doing hockey, now you're doing something else. We're bigging up on football. We're bigging up on basketball. You're now doing something else. Where was the game kept alive? Where did you get information? Where did the discussion continue? Because it wasn't in newspapers, not a whole lot on television, not a whole lot on radio. Me and Bill Waters did an entire program, Leafs Lunch Show, just turned into like the CBA show for an entire year. Everything you wanted to know about qualifying offers, but were afraid to ask, right here on the program. So we did that for two hours a day,
certainty.
Right?
Cost certainty.
But where was the discussion kept alive? Where was the heart of the sport kept alive? It was on the internet, and it was on the blogosphere. That's where I think it really grew, and that was the eruption.
The last word about this Cowherd crap. If you looked around the room in Tortorella's press conference last night, you saw people like, I'm assuming Larry Brooks was there, Bruce Arthur, a lot of guys that are tremendous writers, and a lot of guys that are not young and cheap. And I'm going to leave the final word to Sue Natan, a listener who emails in. I think the first guy who asked a question at Tortorella's presser last night was Stan Fischler.
It was. And at the end,
young
Stan,
and cheap.
Stan
all
had
just young and cheap.
Stan had two last night in the presser as well, because Torts will always use him by name. Not going to answer that, Stan. No, I'm not going to talk about that today, Stan. He'll always do the comma Stan, just like he does comma Brooksy.
Young and cheap.
Not Stan Fischler.
Not in any way, shape, or form.
No. Nope. Man. He used to be, him and his wife Shirley were like the book factories in the late 70s, early 80s, man. I got so many Stan and Shirley Fischler books. Holy smokes. Were you the same weight? Did you collect all those Fischler books?
I have a few. He had
Bad
a really,
Boys
really,
and all that.
He had a really, really good one on the Devils early years leading up to, I think, the first cup, maybe. And just great stuff. A chock full of really cool stuff. Like we actually asked it on Game Show Friday last week, the names that were in contention for the Devils, Mosquitoes,
Gamblers.
Correct. Freaking love that. It's so good. Yeah. I saw something during the Rangers game I wanted to bring up as we get Dee McDermott on the line. Listen, every fan base has suits. We all know where they sit. I try not to be judgmental of the lower bowl just because I didn't sit there. There's a lot of diehard fans in the lower bowl. However, I can't help but notice during a television broadcast that when there is a hand pass in the defensive zone and someone wearing a Brooks Brothers, a very nice suit, stands up and makes the universal symbol for hand pass because he's so pissed off the referee didn't call it.
Yeah.
Listen, Sudi. Hey. Please don't do that. Or if you're going to do it, you know, take the Patrick Kane advice. If you're going to do it, make sure there's not a camera on you, because you're making all of the other suits down low look stupid.
Yeah, so there should be an IQ test when you get those tickets, is what you're saying? How well do you know the rule book?
I don't know. Just because you don't wear a jersey to the game doesn't mean that you're not a good fan. And I've learned that over the years. I've met some really, really rich people who wear suits to the game, and they're just as big a fan as I am when I come and paint my face and shit. That said, Madison Square Garden is one of those buildings where the suit, and I think the Air Canada Center is the same way, correct? Where the suits sometimes are rightfully demeaned by their lack of knowledge about the game they're paying to see.
Because they don't watch the opening of the periods because they're in the president's lounge. That's why the first shot at the beginning of the period, all you see is platinum seats and no one's there.
Our first guest is here, sir.
Yes, he is indeed. Talk about hockey fans. Transplanted Canuck living in Los Angeles. You know him perhaps as Mark Simpson from Power Play. Perhaps you know him from Tori and Dean in Love, Tori and Dean Home Sweet Hollywood. You may know him as a hard rock defenseman on Sergeant Rock's men's league team in the Exclaim Hockey League. Or you may just know him as I do as Dino. Dean McDermott. How you doing today, Dino?
Hey, Jeffy. How are you?
I'm doing great.
It's Wyszynski. I just had a quick question.
Some of those names I haven't heard in a long time. Mark Simpson, that's an oldie.
Power play,
bud.
I had a quick question, Dean.
I had a quick question about your career.
Okay.
In season two of Earth Final Conflict, when you showed up as the real Liam Kincaid, do you find that to be, do you think that's a precursor to the Dick Whitman, Don Draper dynamic in Mad Men? Do you feel like they lifted that from Earth Final Conflict?
Possibly. Because my performance was so mesmerizing and dazzling as the real Liam Neville Kincaid that they're like, wow, we got to steal this kid's thunder.
But you know what they say, Dean? Greatness borrows, but genius steals. So you
exactly,
should consider.
Exactly.
You should be flattered.
I was just about to say that, Jesse.
What is the vibe in Los Angeles for the Los Angeles Kings, sir? What is the vibe out there? Has the buzz built for the Kings for the playoffs?
The buzz and the vibe out here, you know, when you're around the arena, when there's a game, LA King fans are fierce. They're great, great fans. But as far as, you know, sort of buzz extending out through, you know, the rest of Los Angeles, it's not like Canadian teams, you know, where people are flying flags in their cars and they're wearing their shirts everywhere. And, you know, I walk around with my Kings hat on and once in a while I'll get a, you know, great hat, go Kings. But, you know, if we were in Canada, the Canadian team was in the playoffs, and they'd be wearing their jerseys everywhere, the Wall Street, you name it.
Now, how difficult was it for you? Because you're a Toronto guy, and you grew up as a Maple Leafs fan, I believe. You were probably there in 1993 when the Los Angeles Kings knocked off the Toronto Maple Leafs in the conference finals. How difficult was it for Dean McDermott to become a Los Angeles Kings fan, knowing what Gretzky, Rudy, and the bunch did to your team in 1993?
Well, you know, here's the thing. You know, I tweet and Facebook, and people always ask me, you know, who are you rooting for? Are you a Kings fan? Or, you know, when they're in the series of the Canucks, they're like, go Canucks. Hope you're not voting for the Kings. Here's the thing. I'm a fan of hockey, period. You know, I grew up a Leafs fan. I kind of fell off the wagon. And I turned my sights towards Calgary. I'm a Calgary Flames fan. I'm an Oilers fan. I'm just a fan of the game, you know, and the fact that the team that the city I live in now is in the playoffs, I'm going to back them. So,
what's it like?
You know, I'm just a fan of the game. And, you know, people bust my balls about that and me being an expat and all that stuff. But I just love the game. I'll watch any game.
I've been actually pretty impressed with the level of celebrity at Kings games during these playoffs. You know, was a time as a hockey fan in the U.S., Alan Thicke was the biggest celebrity we'd get. but now it's like Kobe Bryant and the Beckhams, and as a geek, Will Wheaton being there is wonderful. But it seems like there is a level of celebrity now, both in New York, both in Los Angeles and New York, where hockey has become kind of celebrity cool.
Yeah, I've noticed that the last game team I went to, we saw Jesse James and Sandra Bullock when they were together. But, yeah, we're seeing more and more celebs all the time. Beckham was a big one. That was a big get. People are understanding the game more as well. You know, I've been going to games over the years, and I see the fans are learning about the rules and stuff like that, and, you know, they're not wanting goals every time someone, you know, gets a shot on the net. So they come around, and again, they're fierce fans. You go to the stadium, and, you know, during the game, they're fierce. But they're coming along. It just needs to spread to the city more.
Now, when you and Tori go to the games, Dean, do you both have the conversation, okay, we know we're going to be on the kiss cam eventually. What are we going to do? Like, how many times have you guys been kiss cammed?
Never.
What?
Never. We were game four against the Canucks, and they came around with the kiss cam, And I looked at T and said, huh, maybe we'll get on the Kiss Cam this time because they were close in our area. And the Kings PR knew we were there. And no, we got shut out on the Kiss Cam. Not once.
Is that insulting? That's got to be insulting, dude.
It's not insulting. I just want to get on the Kiss Cam. I just want to, you know, have that privilege. Like, yeah, I was on the Kiss Cam.
Dean, the obvious answer is just like, on Puck Daddy, we ran a video of Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson on Kiss Cam. So what you need to do is go find Rita Wilson and kiss her during the game. And then you can get on Kiss Cam.
I'll kiss Tom Hanks.
There you go.
Right?
If you can play, you can play.
Listen, I don't know how you guys do things over in Los Angeles, but
that's how we roll out here, man.
You know, in
I'll take Travolta to a game.
And one of the great things, and I'm sure there are other traditions that various people around the United States have to do with hockey and big events, but I can think of a couple of sort of, you know, big, you know, life changing events that have hockey attached to it. One of our one of our teammates, Dean and I's guy Tim, had his stag party. What he did for his stag party, instead of having, like, you know, go to the Rippers and drink and party,
right,
he rented ice for like 5 hours and had a tournament with all of his buddies.
Dean,
I hope you don't mind me telling the story, Dean. When Dean's father passed, he rented ice at Forest Hill Arena and had all of his friends together. It was kind of like a wake for his dad, and it was a game. They got everyone together, and Dean, I still remember that goal you scored. It was like one of the most perfect shots I ever saw in my life. It was like, it's like Dean let this shot go, and you say to yourself, you know, not to get too sort of metaphysical about it, but it's like, those aren't Dean's hands. That's his dad playing that. It was like one of the nicest shots I've ever seen. It was a great moment, great celebration of your dad's life. Have you been able to take sort of any of those, like, big life hockey traditions and bring them to Los Angeles with your, you know, your life now with Tori?
You know, I'm trying to. I just went out the other day and I bought a net and some of the orange street hockey balls and some sticks for the kids. And I really want to get them into hockey and expose them to hockey. They're 4 and 5 now. And, you know, aside from remembering that night and that goal, you know, I remember my dad teaching me how to skate, how to shoot a puck, how to make a pass. So I want to start that tradition, you know, with my kids. And I want to instill that in them. Hockey is such a part of my life and how I grew up. That I want them to have that. I want them to understand, you know, the camaraderie of team sports and fighting for something that you believe in and playing hard with your teammates. And then just the quiet moments of just, you know, passing the puck back and forth with your dad. So that one day when I pass on, they'll have a skating wake for me.
Hey, onto this LA Kings team. Is this team unbeatable, Dean?
You know what? This team is on fire. You know, after game 4, I know they had a healthy lead with the Canucks. And then when they got the other Sedin back, that was the Vancouver team they should have been playing from the start. And I saw a chink in the armor, and I was like, oh, no, is this going to unravel and they're going to get knocked out? And I think they learned from that, and they just came back even stronger. And, you know, the Blues were just – they're in for it. You know, they just beat him up, and Quick has been amazing. They are. I think they're unbeatable. I really do.
You know, when you look at the last, you know, big Los Angeles Kings team to do anything significant in the playoffs, of course, the 93 squad with Gretzky, you know, Wayne was the rock star. You know, Wayne was it. Wayne was Hollywood. Wayne was a big deal. Is not that anyone comes close now, but who's the closest to being the rock star on the Los Angeles Kings now? Who's the big face of the franchise, a celebrity on scene?
You know, it is Kopitar, you know. Hmm. Everybody loves Kopi. Everybody's got, you know, his jersey. But the rock star, in my opinion, and, you know, how hockey should be played, he's got a heart the size of his head, is Dustin Brown. He's been just a stand-up guy. He does everything right. He does everything. He scores goals. He plays defense. He hits like a truck. I just think he's my rock star.
Is there a part of you that Is there a part of you that feels bad about beating up on Phoenix?
No. No. You know, I thought Phoenix, in two games in, but I thought Phoenix would be a bit more of a better opponent. Because they're a big physical team, and I thought, you know, this is going to be quite a good series, and it is. And again, I hope the Kings sweep them. But you know, I'm a fan of the game, and if it were, you know, Phoenix and somebody else, you know, I'd probably root for Phoenix because they're close to home. But I got Kings fever. I got a fever.
The only prescription.
Yeah, and you know what?
For Kings.
And it's funny because our mutual friend Fever, by the way, we were texting earlier, says hello, by the way.
Right.
So a big hello to our man Fever.
We should give a shout out to Johnny Fever, Roly Poly, the big fat goalie. May all your saves be glove side.
last one for me. You got a couple of things in the hop, but I want to give you a chance to pimp out what you're doing. I know you got a website coming up pretty soon.
Yeah,
correct, Dean?
I got a website launch coming up next week. It's demondermot.com. The Gourmet Dad. I go to culinary school out here, Jeffy. And,
what?
I got this passion for cooking and, I'm a dad, you know that. I got four kids,
yeah.
And a fifth on the way. And so, I'm turning that into, a website and a brand and, branching out. I want to open a restaurant and do some cookbooks and it's just a passion I've always had. And now I'm in a place where I can pursue it. So
that's right. By the way,
this go ahead.
I was gonna say, by the way, congratulations on the next kid to come. And that's like that's
thank you.
You got Irish twins coming, bro. It's like what Tori was 5 months and then all of a sudden again.
Yep.
Dude.
Yeah, we came close on the first two. They're 15 months apart, but this one, you know, slam dunk. I made sure they were Irish twins.
Irish twins,
back to
bud,
the
atta boy.
Yeah. Back to the cooking, sir. If you could appear on any program on the Food Ooh. Network, what program would it be?
Chopped.
Oh, you think you could handle Chopped?
Yeah.
Listen to this, Moxie.
Yeah, atta boy, Dean.
Hey, dude, if I could play defense with Jeffy and we can win games, I can win Chopped.
Well, you know I look forward to seeing you take down a basket in which they give you Prosecco, a Trout, and Mike and Ike's. And see what you do with it, sir.
Awesome. Okay, I'm on it.
Dean.
Hey, Jeffy, I gotta embarrass you. You mentioned Sergeant Rock. Do you remember
that
time? Jeff was my defense partner. And we were in the finals, last game.
Oh, yeah.
And you
Forest Hill Arena.
A big cupcake up the middle.
Yeah. That was in the final game.
Oh, really?
And right behind the net. And, you know, see, up the middle passes are so tempting because, you know, for a split second, you think you have the pass and then you fire it. And then out of nowhere, here comes a winger to pick it off. And, you know, the best thing about Dean, and man, you should have just blasted me. Like I cost the team the game. I cost the team the tournament. Hands down. I threw a pizza right up the middle. Cupcake. Ooh, right. I didn't even dent the tape. That's how beautiful a pass this was. And I don't know who it was. Johnny Sinclair, I think, put it behind our goaltender. And here comes Dino with the big arm around my shoulder. That's all right, son. Don't worry about it. We'll get it back. You know what, Greg? We didn't get it back. We ended up losing that game was because of me. So yeah, thanks for the trip down memory lane, Dino. Thanks for that,
hey,
bud.
Hey, dude, you know what though? We lost as a team.
I'm not
going to bust you, but no, we lost to the team.
You know what?
Where was the guy picking up that winger, right?
Exactly. Where's my D partner? Nice coverage.
No,
thanks,
no,
Dean.
No. I had the other guy wide. No. Our wingers.
Are you kidding? The minute the puck turns over in men's league, they fly the zone. They're out. They're between the blue line.
Yeah.
See you later. You got to make long bomb passes. No
yeah.
one's going short
only,
pass in men's league.
The only back check in the shower.
You're
Dean
the best,
McDermott.
Bud. Thanks, bud.
Thank you so much for joining us here.
Hey, thanks for having me. Jeffy, I miss you, man.
Yeah, we'll talk soon, but I'll give you a buzz.
Okay, brother.
See you, dude.
Thanks, guys. Ciao.
Dino is funny, man. I'll tell you, I had more laughs with that guy playing hockey than probably anybody else I've ever played with. That dude is just mint. He is a funny dude, man. Good player, too.
He's a good cat, huh?
He's a good player too. He's a big guy. He's a big, strong defenseman. And, man, this guy can shoot. And I also remember, like, one of my greatest hockey memories still to this day is the, Remember when Dean called us all together and told us about his father passing away, and the one thing he wanted to do was have a wake for his dad. Oh, that's a great idea. He says, no, I want to have a skate wake, though. So we rented the ice, a couple hours, about 20 guys came out, and just had an awesome skate for 2 hours, and then went back in the dressing room and drank to his dad, drank to his old man. It was like a really cool sort of Canadian hockey wake. It's one of my greatest hockey memories of all time.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
We're going to have Kevin Allen in a second here to talk about Tortorella. I wrote about it, obviously, this morning on Puck Daddy. And, you know, like I said, I understand the frustration. I can't get upset about it. I can't get upset about the – when I covered the Rangers and Capitals, I would only go to Torts press conferences if there was a need to, because I knew I wasn't going to get anything. And to me, it was more important to stick around in the Rangers room, talk to guys like Callahan, talk to guys like Lundqvist, talk to guys like, you know, Staal, Girardi, these guys who are going to give me good stuff, who aren't going to be dicks about it, than to go and play in Johnny's media circus. I mean, it just didn't interest me. So
I want to see where it all leads. You know,
yeah.
Like, I want to see where it all goes. Like, I don't want to write the book on John Tortorella's press conferences until the season is done. Like, what happens if at the end of this he comes out and gives a really great detailed explanation of everything that was going on with the New York Rangers at this time and does a, hey, listen, I'm sorry if I offended you guys or made it difficult to do your job, but this is why I did this. Like, I'm not ready to destroy John Tortorella until we hear the entire story. And who knows? Maybe at the end of all of it, he's going to be Denny the Dunce and not say anything as well. But I'm not going to pass judgment until I hear the whole thing.
The hockey writer's take on it, and also on this series, we bring in Kevin Allen, the venerable Kevin Allen of USA Today. I'm Eric Frisbuchinski. Hello, Kevin.
How are you?
Doing well, doing well. You know, Colin Cowherd of ESPN today said that all hockey writers are young, cheap labor. Do you fit into that category, sir?
No, I neither cheap nor young, that's for sure. I happen to watch that, and I think I felt like firing him off an email on behalf of the Professional Hockey Writers Association, because he kind of besmirched us as a group there, I thought. I mean, he kind of made it sound like we were the lowest rung of sports writing, and I certainly don't think that's the case, obviously.
No, not at all. I mean, not at all. I was just going to say something very disparaging about another sport, but I might as well stop. I mean, I know where we are on the totem pole. Kevin, what is the Professional Hockey Writers Association take on the way that John Tortorella is administering these press conferences on game days?
Well, you know, we're in a difficult position because, you know, basically we try to utilize the rules to make our case. And the rules say, you know, he only needs to show up and perform at the press conferences, but, there's no rules saying that he has to be cooperative. And, you know, historically we've had issues with players and coaches. And, you know, our general position is that, hey, as long as they, you know, show up when they're supposed to show up and, you know, they make themselves available. If they choose not to speak to, specific, writers, or if they just choose not to comment, that there's really not a lot we can do. Now, saying all that, I mean, I've been in conversation with the league and registered a protest because, you know, even though he's within the letter of the law, you know, he's crucifying the spirit of the law, because he's just been, you know, non-cooperative. And, you know, now it's become a bit of a joke as everybody measures how long his press conferences are. And, you know, the frustrating part from my perspective is that I've known John for a while, and he can be tremendous as an interviewee. And, you know, we saw that today even, I thought, on the conference call. You know, we got a little more meat. He was more receptive to the lines of questioning like Gabrick. He wouldn't speak about him specifically, but he talked in general terms. And, you know, and that's what coaches do. There are many coaches who don't want to give us anything, but they find a way to do it in a way that isn't rude and abrasive.
Do you think it's a direct reflection, Kevin, to the fines that that have been levied against him this year? So in John Tortorella's mind, it's like, well, if I talk, I get dinged, so best that I don't say anything.
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of different theories floating around. I mean, one is it's that he's still angry over that, and it's best that if he just, you know, not say anything, because he's stopped himself a couple of times. If you you know, listen to any of his tapes. He started to say something, and then he'll say, ah, I'll leave it at that. And then the second theory is that he's trying to remove, you know, a la, you know, Herb Brooks and several other coaches. He's trying to take the pressure off his team by making himself a spectacle. I've heard that as well. Or there's a third theory that he's just generally rude when it comes to these, you know, kind of, you know, situations. And, you know, he doesn't really, you know, appreciate that, you know, this is part and parcel of being a coach that, you know, in my mind, it's, it may not be written in your contract, but, I think, you know, when you do, and act the way he has acted, that, you know, you're doing harm to the game, because this is the time when the sport is being celebrated and, you know, really, you're in the entertainment field and you're not being very entertaining, nor are you providing any information to your, you know, as I like to call them, your stockholders, which are your fans.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because Michael McCarthy from your paper wrote today that Tortorella, in acting childishly and unprofessionally, possibly puts the NHL in a bad light. And I saw Dave Lozo, who was on our show earlier this week, tweet out before that SportsCenter on ESPN dedicated more time to Tortorella's press conference than they did actual highlights from Game 2. So is there something to be said about Tortorella and this stuff he's doing in press conferences overshadowing the stuff that's happening on the ice?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think there is. And, you know, I mean, the question comes down to it, you know, how important is that? Well, I think from the league's perspective, I think it's very important. You know, he always speaks about, Tortorella has about, you know, the game and paying homage to, you know, the game itself. And I think when he doesn't, act as a conduit between, the team and the fans, then he's, you know, he's not fulfilling that duty. And, you know, he makes a pretty good living off of the sport, and he's doing nothing to help, you know, push the sport along in terms of its, you know, national, perspective. You know, in theory, this is, the time when the league, you know, needs to shine and, you know, show what, great athletes they have. And, you know, we kind of need Tortorella to tell us, you know, after the game of what's going on and, you know, especially with his team. Like, and again, I mean, it's bothersome because there are plenty of coaches historically and even currently that, you know, don't provide a lot of information, but they do it in an entertaining fashion. You know, either they make light of it or make a joke of it, or, I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you, or, you know, that's just not something I'm ever going to talk about, you know, that kind of thing. But they're cooperative in other areas, and he just hasn't really done that at all. He hasn't even tried to play the game at all.
Outside of the Tortorella press conferences, what do you make of the series so far? Did last night's result shock Kevin Allen?
No, not really. I mean, I picked the Rangers to win it, but I really thought this was a close series because I think that, you know, the Rangers have been the league's most consistent team. Like, they've been playing the same style, you know, going back to October. They've been in playoff mode for the entire season, just in terms of playing the kind of, you know, shot-blocking, gritty, in-your-face style of hockey that generally does well in the postseason. But, you know, they're up against the Devils team that I think actually has more talent up front. I mean, there are some writers that are still casting the Devils as kind of this 1990 style of defensive zealots, but, you know, they're not that at all. I mean, they have a lot of scoring depth up front, and they've got guys who, you know, can play pretty offensively. And I think they're better offensively than the Rangers. I think they're more dangerous. I think they're just more consistent in their abilities to find open space. And, you know, and this has become an issue last night, but I think it was an issue even before we started. And their scary, dangerous offensive threat, Ilya Kovalchuk, in my mind, is better than the Rangers' scary, dangerous offensive threat, Marian Gaborik. And I think, you know, we always talk about your best players need to be your best players, but I think your most expensive players in the salary cap here, you know, need to be, you know, earning their dollars. And, you know, I think Kovalchuk is earning his dollars more than Gaborik is in this series.
Being the young, cheap hockey writer that you are, You've been around for a bit. What is your reaction to the shot blocking hysteria that we've seen in some places regarding the Rangers style, regarding the Capitals style? It's become one of the stories of the postseason. Do you think it's a little overblown?
Oh, tremendously. Yeah, I mean, you know, I've written the story, you know, probably 8 or 10 times in my career. We usually like to haul out the old chestnuts about every 3 or 4 years when we start talking about it. But I don't see it the way some people, you know, have kind of cast this as, you know, this is sort of like the neutral zone trap in that it's a detriment to the entertainment value of the game. I don't see that at all. I think shot blocking is a highly entertaining form of. I mean, a guy's winding up to the big shot, the guy goes down low, and it hits him, and the crowd gasps. And, you know, I think it's a lot of fun. I don't think that it has nearly the value that, you know, that we're giving it in the playoffs. I mean, if you look at the best shot blocking teams in the league in the regular season, they were the, you know, Minnesota Wild, the Islanders, and Montreal. And I don't need to tell you what links those three teams together. It's nice that you can block shots, but it's only valuable if you play a strong, defensive, tenacious, aggressive game to go with that.
How much do you think, Kevin, given the success of the New Jersey Devils in the postseason, how much of that do you think weighs in on the decision Zach Parise makes come July 1st?
Well, that's a really good question. I would have said none. I thought he had kind of made up his mind. That was my sense. You know, and that's not based on any inside information. That's just kind of reading the tea leaves and, you know, knowing him a little bit. But, you know, as I watched this team perform in the playoffs, I started to convince myself, you know, two things. One, you know, I think he could view this team a little differently than previous stars have viewed the Devils when they wanted to get out, because it is more offensive minded. There's a lot more there than just trying to win, you know, games 2-1 as, you know, Devils teams of a forgotten era have used to do. And secondly, I do think people undersell this, the ability of Lou Lamoriello to convince people to stay. I think players understand that Lou Lamoriello does a really good job. Like, you know, he's not a guy that you want as your best friend, and, you know, he's not warm and fuzzy. But I think everyone respects the job he does because, you know, he's had different coaches and different teams and a lot of different players, and yet year in and year out, he finds some way to be competitive. And, if you're Parise, I'm still betting he's going to go because this is a great opportunity for him to either go home or go to the Red Wings or go elsewhere. But I'm more inclined to say that he'll at least consider staying in New Jersey than I would have been a month and a half ago.
Well, that's fantastic news. Last one for me, Kevin. What's your take on Game 3 between the Kings and Coyotes?
I'm all aboard. Climb aboard. I'm tooting the whistle on you know, Kings Express. You know, they're just churning people up. They're just clicking. They got it all together. They've got that good karma. And, you know, teams used to say they get in that rhythm where you play every other day and you just feel so confident. You go to the rink and you expect to win, and, you know, all the problems that you had in the regular season, you know, it's like a sports psychologist is coming to your room and laying hands on everybody, and everybody feels good about themselves. You know, that's the case. You know, their goalie feels invincible. They believe they're at least invincible. You know, just everything is going well. Now, you know, they could get in the finals and they could lose all that because it doesn't take much, but you know, it feels like a sweep to me. I mean, it really does. And, you know, I kind of root for the Coyotes. I like the job that Maloney has done. You know, he's designing on the dime there, and he's done a good job of it. You know, I think Tippett is an undervalued coach around the league. And, you know, I wish them well. But, boy, it sure feels like a sweep to me.
You know, from the LA Kings point of view, Kevin, last one here, as great as the playoff run has been, and some are saying many are picking them to win the Stanley Cup, how big is these guys were epic underachievers in the regular season? How big is that story when the final book is written on the 2011-2012 LA Kings?
Well, I think it'll all be forgotten if they win the cup. I just think that they complete the quest that Wayne Gretzky had or Bruce McNall had when he brought Gretzky in, and you know that'll be the big story. And you know, Dean Lombardi, I felt, was kind of on the hot seat, and you know, would be a guy that, you know, might be in trouble based on where the team was late in the year. And now, I mean, you know, the way they've played in the postseason, I think he's been vindicated. You know, he was very bold in his decision against Richards and Carter. And you look at the 1-2, you know, center position punch that the Kings have now with the, you know, very fancy, you know, dangerous, dynamic Kopitar and the gritty, you know, defensive-minded center in Richards. You know, that's pretty nice. And now, you know, Carter gets the 3 goals the other night. And, you know, I'm not sure that I want 20 years worth of Carter and Richards on my book, but, you know, right now it's looking great, you know. So I don't know what happened to them. I actually had a conversation with Jack Johnson, who's over in Helsinki. You know, their team was just eliminated today, but a couple of days ago I talked to him about the Kings, and he said, you know, we always knew we were a good team. We just couldn't figure out why, you know, we couldn't get the puck into that. And, you know, I think Sutter has done a good job there, and I can't believe I'm saying that, because you talk about another coach, it's going to be difficult to, you know, get information out of. He's, you know, he's one of those as well, but he's done a good job of making them harder to play with. And, you know, they're getting enough goals. Like, they're not, you know, the Penguins or even the Flyers offensively, but they get enough goals, and that's really all that matters. And, you know, they got a lot of nice parts there. So I'm very bullish on the Kings right now, just because I think they feel so confident.
Kevin Allen of USA Today, thank you so much for joining us here at Merrick vs. Wyshynski, and safe travels. I'll probably see you in the final, sir.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, and I'm always happy to be on with you guys. See you later.
Thanks, awesome. Kevin.
Kevin Allen.
Yeah, he's very good.
We asked you, the listener, to give us what your questions for John Tortorella would be if he's not going to answer hockey-related questions on game days. Mm-hmm. What would you like to ask him? DC would ask him, hey, Torts, do you think Greece is on its way out of the Euro?
You know my
Jonathan
favorite
Dumpy
one game
would
from?
Ask him,
oh, yeah.
Jonathan Dumpy would ask him, what's the food like in the TSN green room? P.G. Marsh would ask, if you could have top half human, bottom half fish mermaid, or top half fish, bottom half human mermaid, which one and why?
That's a very good question. Good. That's a great one. I think bottom half would have to be Faye Dunaway, circa 76.
Eric Grigsby writes in, hold on, John Tortorella, is your beard painted on? It looks fake.
Wow. Wow. You know where my favorite one came in from?
Who's that?
Our good and mutual friend, analyst for the, you'll see them tonight, Phoenix Coyotes, Tyson Nash. Ask him if when he walks in the room, does he hit the jukebox for the pump-up tunes? Hashtag Fonz. Does he look like Henry Winkler to you, John Tortorella?
Completely. Completely.
Like, identical to the Fonz. If Fonz had a salt and pepper beard, he'd be John Tortorella.
Larry McCurtis, you're great at dodging questions, but can you dodge a wrench? Patches O'Houlihan from Dodgeball.
Ooh. Whoa. Ooh.
Pick and pull.
From Mr. Big, have you ever seen a grown man naked? Do you like movies with barbarians? Airplane.
Gladiators. Gladiators.
Oh, is that Gladiators?
Yes.
No, I thought the first one was from Airplane, wasn't it?
No. The reference from Airplane is, do you like Gladiator movies, not barbarians?
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
See how confused I am. It was funny to me.
Collision writes in. This is a dissenting email.
Right.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if I've ever heard an actually insightful, incisive, challenging question from a sports reporter after a game anyway. So maybe we can cut the bullshit and admit we're all just bizarrely desperate to hear the same kind of nonsense every coach gives every time. Just fill in your idiotic coach speak. He pointed out his team needed to improve its compete level and then went on to describe jam, grit, hustle, and accountability as good and necessary things. Asked specific questions he noted that he would prefer to answer after he had seen the tape. He declined to offer any insight into roster or strategic changes, past, present, or future. He thanked us for our time.
How much do writers go into these press conferences already having made up their stories, and all they need is some questions that fulfill a certain quote quota? i.e., I need him to say this, this, and this. I'm going to ask him questions that gives me this, this, and this, so I can finish my story.
Not only that, but they have their questions thought out. Like the most douchey, chilliest thing about the ringing cell phone from Tortorella earlier in the series was the fact that the guy trying to ask the question during it had this setup involving Ruslan Fedotenko's tattoos or something of that such. And he had to do the setup twice for the question. So then you're like, ugh, he's got this thing all planned out like he's a White House press corps member, you know, during question time with the president. So it's all a show. And that's why part of me doesn't mind the Tortorella thing, is because there's a subversive nature to what he's doing, in which he goes into this thing knowing that it's all cliche. He goes into this thing knowing that it's all dog and pony, and he's completely undercutting it. It's like he doesn't have time for this.
Can I give you a wrestling analogy?
Sure.
I don't think you'll mind. I was, this would have been 2002. I was hanging out with, you know, Benoit. The guys I used to hang out with were Benoit, Malenko, Perry Saturn, Eddie Guerrero. Those like the main dudes that I knew. Jericho a little bit. I know him a lot better now. Lance Storm, who I know a lot better now as well. But so I was with the guys that had just come over from WCW, and it was a house show at the Sky Dome. And Malenko had, I think, they were giving the agent, who actually I think it was Joe Scarpa, who just passed away, were giving him 18 minutes for a match. It's pretty long for house show standards, right? So I'm like, Dean, what are you gonna do with your matches? Ah, we got 18 minutes. I got something great planned. I said, what are you gonna do? He's got that great gravelly voice. He says, I'm gonna grab a headlock for 10 minutes. And we all kind of laughed. But you know what he did? He got in there, did a couple of, you know, first couple of minutes, you know, whip into the ropes, stuck clothesline, you know, tackle, all that kind of stuff. And I can't remember who he was working with, but he grabbed a headlock and went down to the mat. And wish he held it there and held it. And honestly, it was like, I was backstage with Saturn, like, holy shit, he's doing a 10-minute headlock spot. He's holding it for like 10. And the crowd initially was like, okay. And then they're like, boo and boring. And then they got mad. And then they got furious, like, just end this, get this over with. And then when the babyface made his comeback, the place exploded. It just was, the explosion for the babyface comeback was huge, because Malenko just sat it out as they were chanting boring at him and booing and this is boring and get this match out of here. He just fought right through it. And that's to my point about John Tortorella. I want to see what happens at the end of all this. I want to see if there's a payoff at the end of all this. Maybe there is, you know, a 45-minute, you know, gloves are off, everything's on the table press conference from John Tortorella. Only at that point will I make up my mind about what this bizarre phenomenon that his press conferences have been. Michael Farber compared it to Japanese Kabuki theater, and I think he's kind of on the money there. I want to see where this thing ends up at the end.
Well, that's all the time we have for our Japanese Kabuki theater today. I am Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet. Hey, you know what tomorrow is? You know what tomorrow? I'm glad, by the way, your voice is feeling better.
Thank you.
Because it's going to be front and center tomorrow for
Game Show Friday.
Oh, they see. I hope it feels.
Yeah, you
got to
work.
More.
You got to work on that, bro. Yeah.
Well, it's the end of the show. I mean, in all honesty.
So did you? So you took care of it a lot. Like you weren't like screaming at the TV last night. The Devils mounted their comeback.
I did not say much during that third period, sir. I just.
How nervous were you? How nervous were you yesterday?
I was.
How was that sequence at the end where Marty tried to fire it up the glass and it came right back into the middle of the ice?
I wasn't a fan.
Had to make a couple of more saves.
I wasn't a fan of that. Wasn't a fan of him putting the puck into his own net. Wasn't a fan of that either.
Yeah.
But I was a fan of that David Clarkson. I'm also a fan of a 1-1 Rangers Devils series heading back to New Jersey.
They say you're never in trouble until you lose at home. Oops.
Yeah, but, you know, in fairness, it'll be a home game for the Rangers on Saturday anyway.
No, they're blocking the blue. Or what's that campaign called?
Yeah, I don't think
is
that
it block
works.
The blue?
They stopped doing it. They deleted the page. Anyways, thank you so much for listening to the show. Thank you to Dean McDermott.
Yeah.
Thank you to Kevin Allen. Thank you to you. And thank you to Elena. And we'll be back tomorrow. Talk to you then.
We will. Right here.
Bye.
True.